With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome to the Cozen Podcast. This is a special episode to mark the re-release of Howard's End, and we are here with our guest, Samuel West.
Hello.
Is it Sam or Samuel?
A Sam in person and Samuel West in credits.
So we go with Sam.
We go with Sam.
Great. Often actor, sometimes director, always geek, is Sam West's Twitter biography. He was born in London. He's the child and grandchild of actors. He studied English literature at Oxford, and then he embarked on a very successful stage, screen, and radio career, which has seen him play leading roles such as Hamlet and Richard III at the RSC. Sorry, Richard II.
Well done, you corrected yourself.
I even saw that. I queued from 4 o'clock in the morning to get tickets for the last performance of that, and it was wonderful. Mm-hmm. He also starred in Tom Stoppard's original production of Arcadia at the National Theatre. And he took up many roles in some of the nation's favorite TV series, including Midsummer Murders, Poirot, and recently Mr. Selfridge, and Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. And he even performed at the Last Night of the Proms.
In 2002, I did.
Excellent. We haven't even mentioned in passing that he's also a director, as his Twitter bio says, and he was artistic director of Sheffield Theatres for 3 years.
Two seasons, so three years in total, yeah.
Where he revived Howard Brenton's controversial play, The Romans in Britain. So am I right in thinking that Howard's End was your feature film debut?
Not quite. I did one film before called Reunion, which went to the Cannes Film Festival, and also a little one in French called Archipel, which nobody's ever seen.
Oh,
but
no.
This was my first big film.
How old were you at the time?
I remember celebrating my 25th birthday on set, so I must have been 24. 25.
That's amazing. So Howard's End is the film that we're here to talk about today. It was directed by James Ivory and produced by his longtime partner Ismail Merchant, who sadly passed away recently. It was one of the most successful films out of the whopping 24 films that they made together as Merchant Ivory, which truly established a global reputation as a production house that specialised in sumptuous period dramas. On its original release in 1992, Howard's End played at Curzon Cinemas for 54 uninterrupted weeks, which I think is the record for any film.
That's remarkable.
Yeah, 34 of those weeks were at Curzon Mayfair, where the film is returning this summer in a beautiful 4K restored version courtesy of a BFI. So Howard's End is the story of three families from different economic backgrounds. It's set in London, and their fortunes are interwoven against a backdrop of class difference and essentially what was a housing crisis in 1910. But I want to travel back to the time when the film was made. So it's 1991. Mm-hmm. How does Sam West, age 24 or maybe 25, recent graduate, an early career stage and film actor, get the part of Leonard Bast in Merchant Ivory's upcoming production of Howard's End?
It's a very good question. Looking at it now, I mean, Leonard is a lower middle class clerk, and I've never really played anybody else lower middle class. It's still the film that most people have seen me in, so it's not really typecasting. I think nowadays I wouldn't be seen for that role.
It is striking. You sound very much working class in the film, and I was very surprised to hear this Sam West voice.
Well, I grew up in South London,
and
if I go and watch my football team, I still talk like that. So, actors should strive to be classless, I think.
Absolutely.
And a lot of Leonard's background is very similar to mine, at least in place and in sound some of the time. But I auditioned. I was lucky enough to have an agent who knew I loved the book. And I auditioned twice, I think. I don't remember having a screen test. I think I must have met James two or three times. And I know that when it came down to the final choice, there were only two of us. Because
wow.
I know who the other actor was, who shall have to remain nameless. But I owe him a drink. And he was pleased that I knew the book and made sense of the character, I suppose. And I was offered it. I knew had worked with Helena in a play at university. So that might have been something that got me in the first place. Because she'd obviously worked with Jim before on Room with a View.
This is Helena Bonham Carter.
Sorry, Helena Bonham Carter.
Who plays
Helen Schlegel, confusingly, who is one of these two sisters. You mentioned three families. So we've got the Schlegels, who are liberal, nowadays you'd call them feminist, blue stocking, liberated women.
European origin?
German and proud of it. Countrymen of Goethe and Schiller and very much given to culture in all its forms and driven and excited by that. And then you have the Wilcoxes. Mrs. Wilcox played by Vanessa Redgrave, Mr. Wilcox played by Anthony Hopkins, and their two sons, one of whom Helen briefly falls in love with at a sort of house party. And the Wilcoxes are in business, and except Mrs. Wilcox, who is sort of in a world of her own, and she owns this house called Howards End, and she is dying. And Margaret, who meets her through Helen's involvement with the younger Wilcox son, and Margaret and Mrs. Wilcox become friends, and Margaret visits Howards End, and on her deathbed, am I allowed to say this? You can cut it out if this
is spoiler alert.
On her deathbed, Mrs. Wilcox writes a short note saying, "I would like Miss Schlegel, brackets Margaret, to have Howards End." And the Wilcoxes go, "What is that, legally binding? Come on, that's ridiculous. She was out of her mind." And they decide not that it shouldn't happen. But the connection between the families is made, and eventually Margaret and Mr. Wilcox, the widower, marry.
This is about 25 minutes of the film, isn't it?
Yeah. It's a lot's happened.
Yes.
And then we discover that a third family called the Basts, Jackie and Leonard, played by me, have a connection with the Wilcoxes because Jackie Wilcox, before she was married, had an affair with Henry, Mr. Wilcox, who now has married Margaret. And we find ourselves at their wedding party, and Mr. Wilcox thinks that Margaret has done this thing on purpose, which is not true. And they argue, and meanwhile, Leonard, separated from Jackie, has met Helen, who is still interested in him. It's a long story as how they get involved. And they sleep together, and Helen becomes pregnant. And the final circle of the full turn is that Leonard is killed by Charles Wilcox, the older Wilcox son, who goes to prison. And the younger, and Helen has a baby who she calls Leonard, and he inherits the house. So there is we think he inherits the house. So there is a sort of, if you call it a housing crisis, I mean, there is the central character is the house, which incidentally doesn't have an apostrophe. It doesn't belong to Howard. It's just the name of the house. And the house is very, very important to Mrs. Wilcox and becomes very important to Margaret. And that's where Leonard is killed. And his illegitimate child ends up owning it. So there is obviously an argument about land and about housing to be had, and about class to be had, through this extraordinarily complicated interweaving of the three families.
Do you think there's also a sense of a house becoming a home once it means something to people, and then eventually these people who do inherit the house become its real honours and become the soul of it?
I think it's hard to say that Mrs. Wilcox didn't inhabit it. Mm. I'm not sure Mr. Wilcox and the other Wilcox children did quite, but Mrs. Wilcox, when we first meet her in the book and also in this beautiful shot in the film, which is, I think, the first shot of the film, of Vanessa walking over the wet lawn and pulling the dew up with her skirt of her dress, she is basically associated with the house and is it, really. She feels something for it that she thinks only Margaret will understand. Mm. And gradually, eventually, I think Margaret comes to understand it. But yes, Forster is very supportive of that identification with the place you were born. I mean, the Wilcoxes lose their house because the lease runs out. And Helen and Margaret and Mrs. Wilcox, during one of their days out in London, she says, we're going to lose our house. And Mrs. Wilcox says, oh, how terrible. And Margaret says, oh, well, no, we can get another one. And she says, yes, but not the house you grew up in, not the house you were born in. That you can only ever, you know, have that one. And she seems to feel it deeper than well, it's like running through her like seaside rock. Mm-hmm. And Margaret goes, oh, is that what houses are? And sort of seems to learn from Mrs. Wilcox a little bit about the identification with this central character, you know, which is the house. So it's quite hard to make a film in which the central character doesn't speak, but somehow it sort of does speak, and it is there, and it's very beautiful.
It also appears quite rarely, the house, the actual Howards End. There are lots of other interiors, lots of other homes, lots of other houses.
Yes.
But you see Howards End only at crucial moments. And interestingly, you mentioned the opening shots with Vanessa Redgrave walking through the lawn, and that's replicated later when Emma Thompson's character, Margaret, finally does get to Howards End for the first time.
Yes.
And she does the exact same walk, and
she
it's
does.
Almost as though, yes, finally, you know, this house is where it belongs, with the person
yes.
in it, that belongs in it.
So. There's a story that they're told that there are teeth, pig's teeth, in a particular tree, a horse chestnut tree, although in the book it's an elm. Of course, there aren't any elms anymore, so you have to change it. But there was this huge horse chestnut in the foot of the garden, and Margaret looks for the teeth and finds them. And I think nobody else really believes the story, but she finds them and goes, okay, so that's I'm meant to be here somehow, you know. That's part of me now.
She mentions it to Mr. Wilcox, and he doesn't even know the story.
He's never heard the story.
He's never heard the story.
Yes, that's a very telling moment.
Yes, it's almost as though the two women are actually sharing some secrets that the men don't know.
Well, that sense of sharing across boundaries, I mean, famously, this is the book where the phrase "only connect," which is now, you know, brilliantly famous and successful quiz show, but originally is mentioned for the first time in this book. In fact, it's the motto of the book, isn't it? It's actually underneath the title in the first edition. And Forster's point is that I think men in particular, and men in business in particular, are very good at compartmentalising things and not making connections between, their actions and their consequences, perhaps,
mm-hmm.
would be the nicest way of putting it. And the women, conversely, do that across class and across time and generations and across houses in this case.
Where did you encounter Ian Forster's book for the first time, and is there something in his work that particularly attracted you to work here?
It was, I'm ashamed to say, it was my favourite novel. It's too wonderful when you meet a book. I was a 15-year-old sort of left-leaning, vaguely hippie-ish student, and it completely knocked me sideways, as it still does a lot of 15-year-old vaguely left-leaning people. I found Forster's sort of quiet grey politics, as in not sort of black and white, very, very powerful, and also moments where he would just come out of the book and say, you know, this is what I think and so should you, because I think I'm right. And I was captivated by the book and read it many times, and then, yeah, extraordinarily luckily had the chance to be in it. I mean, I think knowing a book very well is not always a good idea when you're in an adaptation of something. But in this case, if you've got Ruth Prior Jabala writing the screenplay, you know it's going to be a version, as any version has to be, but it's going to be a good one.
You also have a part in a film called Carrington, which is about Dora Carrington and Lytton Strachey,
yeah.
Who were friends with Forster, and they were all part of the Bloomsbury group, which included Virginia Woolf famously. So I guess you're attracted to literary work.
Well, I was just very lucky to be in that. And also the second time I worked with Emma Thompson. I count myself extremely lucky to have done two films with Emma, and I hope might do another in the course of time. But yeah, two enormously enjoyable jobs at the very beginning of my career.
Excellent. So I wanted to talk a little bit actually about Emma Thompson and about the extraordinary awards journey of the film, because Howard's End was nominated for 9 Oscars. Mm-hmm. It won 3, including Best Actress for Emma Thompson, and it was her first Oscar win. Mm-hmm. She went on to win an Oscar for Best Screenplay.
She's
for
still the only person to win as a writer and a performer.
Absolutely extraordinary, I think. And Howard's End also won Best Screenplay and Best Art Direction. Mm-hmm. And it was also nominated for 11 BAFTAs, including Best Film and, again, Best Actress for Emma Thompson. And you were also nominated for a BAFTA.
I was.
And I was wondering how you experienced the successful journey of this film and whether the awards context was as much of a circus as it feels like these days, or what did it mean at the time?
I worked with Glenda Jackson on a radio play recently, and she told me that she discovered that the second time she won a Golden Globe was when she opened the Hollywood Reporter, and it was on the inside page, about page 3. She'd won a Golden Globe the previous night, and I said, that is incomprehensible to me.
Absolutely.
And she's like, no, it was very nice, you know. Lovely to read that in the paper. But there was no ceremony, and she hadn't been invited, or that they had, and she hadn't gone, or whatever.
What year was this?
Oh, it was 1970 sometime.
Wow.
The BAFTA that I was nominated for was I lost to Gene Hackman, which was wonderful to lose to him in Unforgiven.
If you have to lose to someone.
Yeah, exactly. And I went to the BAFTAs, but they weren't on television then. Mm. And when the film came out, I didn't work for about 4 months. So, you know, it was nice to get the recognition, and it's not really about the awards, although I'm really pleased that Emma won, because I think it's a great performance, and I'm delighted that Luciano Righi, who designed the film, got an Oscar for Art Direction. There's one particular moment.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Where I just thought, oh, this is really classy. In our flat, the Basts live in a little flat that was filmed in near Borough Market, tiny little place that really hadn't been redecorated since probably when the book was set in about 1908. And there's a shot where a train goes past and you can see Jackie in my bed. And they do the train with that old sort of Arnold Ridley ghost train thing of a rotating triangular pillar covered in mirrors that you shine a spotlight on, and they spin it, and the train things seem to go past the window. And that was really simple, and that worked, and you put the noise of a train on afterwards. But the moment that I have to point out to people is that Jackie, who has had a past as a prostitute and is now of the age where she thinks, you know, is my skin still good, dyes her hair. And rather than just go to, get the hair done in a modern way, the production design and the makeup and hair said, okay, what would she have done as a woman in 1908? So she bleaches it, and then she turns it yellow with turmeric.
Wow.
Which is what people use to make blonde. And if you look very, very carefully in that scene, you can see the stain of yellow from the turmeric on her hair, on her pillow.
What an amazing touch.
Yeah, well, that's how you win Oscars for production
design.
Absolutely.
That's very impressive. Do you have any other very vivid memories from the set or any stories that you can share with us from that time?
I remember there's a scene where I have to go to the house to try and find Helen, and who is at the time carrying my child without me knowing. And I got off the train and walked up to the station master, who was an extra and didn't have any lines, and I said, I'm looking for a house called Howard's House. And he said, Howard's End, sir. Yes, straight up, first on the left, you can't miss it, 2 stories, 8 windows. I said, that's, and the James said, cut. I said, that's a very good description. How did you know? He said, read the book, didn't I?
Excellent. Another fan.
Yeah. It's very good. It was a very happy shoot. I remember I did 28 days on it over a few months, and then we did a reshoot at the end. There was a little bit more of the Helen Leonard story. So there's a scene where I'm walking down a road flapping on a very hot day just before I get killed, where I'm extremely tanned because I've done another film in between and it doesn't match up at all. Nowadays they just digitally change the colour of my skin. But the reshoots went well, and it was very nice to be told after the shoot that they liked what we were doing and they wanted to do more of that. So there's a little bit more of Helen and Leonard. One of the very happiest jobs I've ever done.
That's great. Leonard, you mentioned, is a keen walker. He does a lot of walking. And I know from following you on Twitter that you are a huge nature lover.
Mm.
So we can't really get away without talking about my favourite scene in the film, which is the bluebells.
Yes, there's an interesting story behind that.
Excellent. Well, we want to hear all about that. And I wonder if you can also talk a bit about Leonard's relationship with nature and why does he have this gorgeous scene in the middle of a film that could be so urban?
Well, Leonard is a clerk in a central London insurance office. There's one thing I did, actually, that I hadn't thought of for years and years as part of my preparation for the role. It sounds very grand to call it preparation for the role, but I grew one of my thumbnails because clerks used to have long thumbnails to help them count things.
Oh.
And I thought, well, nobody ever noticed. But actually, when I get the card from Helen Schlegel, there's a close-up of my thumbnail, which is really long. So I managed to get it into the film. So that's a nice... If you think, why is his thumbnail so long? That's
better because, get in detail.
There you are. So Leonard famously, in the book, decides to go walking one night. He presumably takes the tube out to the end of the district line, something like Wimbledon, which would have been a village at the time, and then just walks on the South Downs or just keeps going. And he doesn't really know where he's going, and he forgets to bring any food. He's got a packet of cigarettes to make, you know, stave off the hunger pains. And it's a very important moment for him, not because it's magnificent, but because he does it. He doesn't really expect to find anything magnificent, and he doesn't. And then through a strange action of losing his umbrella and going back to the Schlegel's house to pick it up, he gets into conversation with them and they talk about this journey that he's taken. And it's really the making of Leonard, because he's got all these pretensions about, you know, wanting to be accepted in polite society. And he's the descendant of agricultural labourers, and he doesn't really belong in that society. And suddenly he realises that, and he drops all the pretension. And there's this wonderful conversation where he says, yes, I walked all night. And one of the sisters says, and did you see the dawn? He says, yes, suddenly it got light. And the other one says, and was it magnificent? And Forster says, with unforgettable sincerity, Leonard said, no, it was only grey. And suddenly all the pretension drops off him and they see the dignity of the man and what Forster calls the spine that might have been straight. You know, swapped the dignity of the animal for a tailcoat and a couple of ideas. It's a brilliant phrase. And so we played this scene and it was really important because they go, there's something about this man. They get interested in him, which turns out to be fatal. But they want to know him again, and then we did the walk. We filmed the walk, and I walked through these extraordinary bluebells, And this was the only time that James Ivory and I ever had what sort of amounted to a disagreement, because I said, Jim, I've got this line, you know, where she says, was it magnificent? And I say, no. And it's really important that it shouldn't be magnificent. And yet I'm walking through these extraordinary bluegrass. You know, it's not just the most beautiful thing I've ever done in a film, but possibly the most beautiful thing I've ever done in my life. And he said, oh, but it has to be beautiful. Otherwise, where are we? And it's become a really iconic image of the film. And so, you know, that was just one way of looking at that scene, that, you know, we had these amazing carpet of bluebells just behind the house in Oxfordshire. And they were out in April. And he said, look, we're going to shoot. And we went and we shot, and the rest is history, as it were. But it doesn't really make sense of Leonard saying it was only dull. So, yeah, we had a disagreement about that. But I'm very glad we did, because it's a beautiful moment.
Excellent. So it's interesting that you say about how, you know, he decides to drop his pretensions, because then what I think Helen says to him is, were you following your ancestors? Were you trying to go somewhere in rural nature and find yourself there? And obviously that's a completely romanticized idea about this man that she has.
Yes.
She's probably picked it up from literature.
Yes, well, I mean, when they get into the boat, they have this moment where you know, where the child is conceived after the wedding, where Leonard goes off and Helen goes with her, and she says, you know, you're not just that, your culture and ideas, and he says, no, that's for rich people to make them feel good after their dinner. It's absolutely clear-sighted, cold thing of, you know, this is not my world and you don't know. It's a very interesting moment in the book where he's reading Ruskin, who's got this beautiful prose style, and he tries to copy Ruskin and describe, you know, his flat, and he decides it doesn't work, and that the phrase for his flat is, his flat was dark as well as stuffy. And I remember thinking, I trust Forster now. I trust him because he puts stuff in like that. And I trust Leonard, actually. Playing Leonard was really interesting, because I'm not sure in the book that Forster quite knows who he is. He knows who he represents. You know, he's a man on the edge of an abyss who falls into it and is killed. And, you know, we know those people, and there are just as many of them as there were then. And the question is, what does society do about them? And Mr. Wilcox famously says, the poor are poor, one is sorry for them, but there it is. And I think that's not too far away from current government policy about people like that, which, you know, is a bit depressing given that it's 100 and something years since. But I think Leonard stands for something in the book, which Forster didn't know quite as well as he thought he did. So embodying somebody like that and having to play him and make sense of him was really a nice challenge. And on the whole, people seem to think that, you know, he became a real person, and I'm very proud of that.
You mentioned something that James Ivory said to you, it has to be beautiful. Mm. This sentence to me describes his cinema. It has to be beautiful. Everything in his films looks absolutely sumptuous. Mm. And we mentioned the production design by Luciano Righi, the costumes by Jenny Bevan, who is now, you know, double, triple Oscar winner.
Yes, extremely.
An absolutely incredible talent. And everything in his films looks so opulent. But I've actually heard recently that Merchant Ivory, in fact, work with very small budgets. They relied on the kindness of friends.
Yeah, they both, most of the stuff that Luciano puts in the back of any posh interior is borrowed.
It's,
you're
it's
not
amazing.
Allowed to touch it.
It's amazing.
Well,
because
that's how producers work.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Ismail was famously he would grin and nod happily if you called him a rogue, but you know, that sort of hand to mouth existence that said, you know, we have some rich friends who might lend us a couple of statuettes and we're going to film the fuck out of them. You know, let's see what we can get. Let's see what we can get out of them. Is exactly how you have to make films if you're not making them with, you know, major studios.
Yeah, so filmmakers, look for a budget, go and find some posh friends.
Yeah, but I think it's important we say something else about Jim, because, you know, his films are beautiful, and the BBC have just made a television adaptation of of Howard's End, and I think it's going to be a different way of telling the story. I think Jim's version is about the relationships and less about the politics, and now possibly there'll be more about the politics and less about the relationships. But there is something about James Ivory's eye which, it's important, is not just beautiful. I remember another film I admire hugely is Wim Wenders' Paris, Texas. And Wim Wenders, of course, is not from Texas or indeed America. And he used to be asked when he was filming on location where he was from, and he always used to say Europe rather than, you know, Germany. And he didn't need to say anything more. They were happy with the fact that he had an outside eye that gave him a slightly sort of, not exactly skewed, but side-headed, turned eye on this rather odd country. And I think Jim has the same. I mean, of course, he sees England with great affection, but he isn't English. Mm. And he's also able to see a lot of the structures, which we're too buried in. I mean, you know, brilliant description of being British is that you have to live according to a set of rules, only nobody tells you what they are. And I think Jim maybe sees them a bit more clearly and sees their ridiculousness a bit more clearly and is able to pick out, you know, their beauty and their history and also their stupidity because he's American and he's got this outside eye.
You mentioned the politics in the film, and it's always very tempting to think of costume dramas as completely detached from our lives, you know, almost like a brand of fantasy films. They can also be very conservative as a genre, but where do you see the politics of the film, and what do you think Howard's End can say to us in 2017?
Well, I mean, I'm sure that conservatives and left-wingers alike would agree that it has something to say about social mobility and how the Wilcoxes believe that social mobility is a mistake, and that, you know, as Mr. Wilcox says, the poor are poor, one is sorry for them, but there it is. And that, you know, people are in certain classes for certain reasons, and one can treat them well. One can tip them, for instance, which Mr. Wilcox says, you know, tip everywhere, that's my motto. But one doesn't really want to tip them so much that they'd have so much money that they could move out of their situation and become one's neighbours. And indeed, when they try, they get killed, which is what happens to Leonard. You know, he's mixed up with the Schlegels because he loses an umbrella. He engenders a child with one of them, and he's murdered. And, you know, Forster's saying, he's not saying, stay where you are, lower classes. He's saying, just, you know, this is the thing that comes to bear on somebody who tries to move. And I'm not sure that really has changed very much. I think we still see an underclass. You know, we're 4 weeks today away from the Grenfell Tower fire, which is in North Kensington. And in South Kensington, the same bit of the same constituency, you know, that the idea that you would clad your home in flammable cladding in order to save a few hundred thousand pounds is absolutely unthinkable. So that division exists, you know, down the road. And so in this case, I think the story is not particularly conservative. I don't think the filmmaking is as radical as possibly it might be telling that story, but I think Ruth's script is very sensitive to those beliefs and honours Forster's, you know, vaguely left-leaning belief that things should be more equal and people should be more mobile.
Well, that's an excellent place to end it, with some idealism, optimism and hope for the future. Howard's End is re-released by the BFI in a stunning 4K restoration. I've just seen it on a big screen. It's amazing. It's on Friday 28th of July. You will see it at Curzon Mayfair, and you absolutely should, particularly if it's your first time watching this film. Mm-hmm. But if you are a returning viewer, I absolutely encourage you to see it. Sam West, it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you so much for
your time.
Pleasure.
Cheers.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.